From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show, and even if I say so myself, it's really good.
I knew for some time that I was no longer a Christian. But what I really struggled with was no longer being a minister.
Right.
Because that was my place in the community.
Earlier this year, Jerry DeWitt led the first service of the Community Mission Chapel. Here's three things that stand out about that. First, DeWitt is a former longtime fundamentalist pastor. Second, the chapel is in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And third, its congregation comprises people who, in the words of its mission statement, seek community within the secular movement. That's right, a church for humanists and atheists. The concept recently has been making headlines, but founding such a congregation in the heart of the Western Bible Belt by a local former Pentecostal clergyman? That's unexpected and a guaranteed source of controversy. On this week's show, you're going to meet Jerry DeWitt and hear the story of his ministry.
I love the commercialization of Christmas because it spreads the Christmas cheer. It's the most jolly holiday, obviously, on our calendar. It's wonderful.
Sarah Palin may not have a problem with the incessant commercialization of Christmas, but a lot of us do have a problem with that. As commerce seems to be elevated to the level of church, many things fall by the wayside. One of those things is the simple pleasure of celebrating Thanksgiving with family and friends. As the incessant creep of the holiday shopping season causes greedy retailers to open their doors earlier and earlier on Thanksgiving Day. This year, more workers than ever before will be minding the store instead of stuffing the turkey. And on this week's show, Bishop Dwayne Royster of Philadelphians Organizing to Witness, Empower, and Rebuild to talk about the toll this takes on workers, families, and our values. But first,
the verdict is in for United Methodist pastor accused of breaking church law by officiating the same-sex wedding of his own son.
What is my crime? I blessed two people that loved each other.
This week, a jury of United Methodist clergy found one of their own, the Reverend Frank Schaefer, guilty of breaking his vows in connection with the longtime Lebanon, Pennsylvania pastor having performed a same-sex marriage ceremony for his son. The sentence is a 30-day suspension with some strings attached. Even as several similar cases were working their way through the United Methodist judicial system, other clergy and congregations within the denomination are openly challenging the church's position on marriage equality. Perhaps the most visible was the November 9th wedding of two longtime male members of Arch Street United Methodist Church in Philadelphia, with 36 of the denomination's clergy officiating. Joining me now is the pastor of Arch Street, the Reverend Robin Heinecke, who led that November 9th ceremony. Reverend Heinecke, I know it's been a busy week. Welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much.
If you would, just briefly describe the United Methodist Church's official position on same-gender marriage.
Our official position is stated and represented in what we call our Book of Discipline. The Book of Discipline is the place where official statements around social issues, as well as how we organize ourselves, both internally to the church and externally to the world. It is the book that guides us to be evident and unified in our work as the United Methodist Church. It is a living document, though. It is a document that gets amended and changed every 4 years at our general conference, which, when convened, has a little under 1,000 delegates, equal numbers of delegates being lay and clergy, and everything and anything that's in that Book of Discipline is open for change.
Mm-hmm. And you all have already, as the Methodist Church, have revisited this issue of same-gender marriage, and so far it hasn't been changed, right?
That's correct. But it's even more important to understand, it's not only have we tried to change it, but we've even tried to have language included in the discipline that would say that we're a church that is divided on this issue, and that good people on both sides of this question can exist, coexist within our denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And even that kind of statement has been rejected.
I wish you would talk about that extraordinary ceremony held in your church on November the 9th.
It was a matter of pastoral conscience. It was an act of providing the liturgy of the church, the Christian marriage ceremony, to a longtime, loving, committed couple who just happened to be of the same gender. Two men, 20-year members of Arch Street United Methodist Church, one of whom was very seriously ill a year ago, and while he was contemplating his life, requested that, if at all possible, at some point, he would love to be married to his 25-year partner, and he would love to be married in the church that he loves. Little did we know that we'd be able to make that dream come true. And as I said in my homily that day, he could have been wanting to do anything. He could have wanted to say, "Dear God, make me straight so I'll go to heaven." But he didn't. He said, "Let me celebrate the love that I know and the person that God made me to be, and let me do it in my church." And that is at the center of what we did on November 9th. Headlines have said that we were defying the church. That is not true. We were offering the liturgy and the ceremony and the welcome of the church to fully include a gay couple into the worship of our church.
Robin, I am a pastor myself, and so I am sensing the compassion that I hear in your voice for those two guys and for their desire to have the church bless their relationship. Thinking of myself in your situation, I think compassion would be there. I also think anger would be there in me. I don't know whether that's true for you or not, but is it a mixture of feelings about love for your denomination and also anger at their reticence to move forward?
I don't know if anger is the word for me. I am angry at times.
Mm-hmm.
I am frustrated at times. I have a mixture of emotions.
Sure.
But the motivating factor for that wedding on the 9th of November was the love and compassion I saw in one of my clergy colleagues, Frank Schaefer, for his own son and his own family. And everything we did was not motivated by anger at the church or anger at any wing of the church. Our motivation was the love and the grace of God that we believe is all-encompassing and all-inclusive. Yeah. The service itself was a celebration of love, God's love, redeeming, God's welcoming, God's gracious love to every and all people. That was the message that we were sending.
There were other clergy standing with you endorsing that. What is the real risk that the officiating clergy members were taking by being there?
The same risk that Frank Schaefer faced going into his trial, the same risk that he faced in his decision to perform the same-gender marriage ceremony for his son. We risk being the object of a complaint and entering into that process, first supervisory process, and then beyond that, a charge that we violated the discipline. One of the tragedies of the trial that we just witnessed was that it was so narrowly focused. No one was allowed to really open up the entire document of the Book of Discipline. There are, you know, inconsistencies there, and there are opportunities to demonstrate good pastoral care even in the midst of what others would say is a violation of the discipline.
Right.
It was a missed opportunity in many respects because it could have been an opportunity for real dialogue as opposed to simple ecclesiastical judgment and justice.
Right.
Justice was not served, but ecclesiastical judgment. It could have been an opportunity for the trial court to, among themselves, talk about how this might be a restorative justice opportunity. In fact, the witness, Janet Wolfe, so beautifully articulated how the church could have operated in this, and they missed an opportunity
right.
to do that.
I know that you were able to be at least at one day of the trial. What was that like?
It was surreal. I mean, to me, it was archaic. It just seemed like, haven't we grown from this? We've learned new ways. Look at the world and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa and restorative justice that the Mennonites and others practice. We've come so far from just simple, straightforward, oh, you broke a rule and you need to be punished for that. We should be well beyond that.
Yeah.
And for me, that was the real tragedy of that. We didn't call upon the wisdom and the tradition that Methodists say we can call upon to allow the Holy Spirit to move through a situation like that.
Yeah.
We just took the low road and said, just the facts, and don't even think or talk or live into why the facts are the way they are.
As I understand it, the 30-day suspension given to Reverend Schaefer also requires that he renounce his position on inclusive marriage. Am I right that he has said that he will stand his ground?
My understanding is that unless he states unequivocally that he will keep the entire book of discipline, then he is being asked to surrender his orders.
Mm.
That's what I understand the verdict to be. There will be a lot of discussion and interpretation of all of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It seems to me cruel and unusual punishment in that, you know, they're asking him to surrender his orders.
How can this change?
Oh, I think it changes by what we did on the 9th. I think we have to create a grassroots movement. I think laity and clergy and community supporters and allies really need to make it clear that in our context, especially the context of a center city congregation like mine, we need to take the context into consideration.
Yeah.
The other thing is we need to really debate and answer and talk about what's really at the root of this, and that is the great division, not only in our church, but in all communities,
right.
about homosexuality or one's gender identity or sexual orientation, because it's clear that the prosecuting side of all of this holds the belief, the unwavering belief, that homosexuality is a sin,
right.
whereas I believe that one's sexual orientation, homosexuality, is part of our very being. It's part of our creative nature. It's who God made us.
Yeah.
And so that's the real question. Do you believe it's sin, or do you believe it's a part of who people truly are by God's making at their birth? And until we are honest enough to ask that question and create what I would call a biased balance, see, part of what I would challenge the trial court, was there a biased balance there?
Mm.
Because the right question, I think, at the outset probably wasn't asked. The question was, do you believe homosexuality is a sin, or do you believe a person's sexual orientation is a gift from God?
Yeah.
And I think if we can honestly start at that place, we know where people are. Mm. That's why that prohibition is in the discipline, because those who think that homosexuality is a sin have been able to muster enough votes to make that statement be there.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of us who have followed medical science, have seen psychiatry move homosexuality away from a disorder into a natural part of a person's being. I mean, all of science and all of our experience at this point, even Governor Christie in New Jersey is saying conversion therapy is not healthy, is not helpful, and it's harmful. So part of that is where this discussion has to get. And we're not going to get there in legislative sessions because folks just want to cut conversation.
Sure.
We need to create conversation. And that's what the wedding did. The wedding created more conversation and has allowed folks who have been relegated to the wings and to the shadows of the church to come out and say, I believe that you're doing the right thing.
Why is this so terribly important to you?
Based on my pastoral experience with folks who have come out to me over the years, over my 35 years of ministry, beginning in college, where friends in college came out and spoke of the isolation and the fear and the heartache that they feared they were giving their parents and giving their friends, and watching folks and pastoring and living out my friendships and my pastoral care over these years, and just seeing people work hard at trying to make change or to hide and to be behind closed doors, and just seeing them blossom when they were able to accept themselves for who God had made them to be. It's based on my experience. It's based on my understanding of good medical science and good psychological science. It's based on my reading of Scripture.
Sure.
I believe God is love. And Jesus really spoke more about greed and how we misuse our resources than he ever spoke about this topic, never spoke about this topic. And if someone disagrees with me, for me, I say to them, this is how I've come to this conclusion. And I give them some very specific examples about people I've known along the way. And I said, this is why I believe. But if you don't believe the way I do, that's fine with me. I can still be your pastor. I can still love you. But if that's a deal breaker for you to be under my leadership or to be in this church, then let me help you find a place where you can get the pastoral care you want and worship the way you need to worship at this point in your life. I am not going to hold you back. I am not going to condemn you for being where you are. But I need you to know where I am. And in fact, every person who comes to me in seeking membership, we have that conversation up front so they know exactly where I am. And if it's not a deal breaker for them, even if they disagree with me, we welcome each other with open arms and we go about our way and do God's work.
The Reverend Robin Heinicke is pastor of Arch Street United Methodist Church in Philadelphia. Even as the issue of marriage equality painfully divides the denomination, he recently officiated a wedding of two men at his church that was co-officiated by over 50 fellow clergy members. The church website offers a moving statement on why they chose to do what they did, and we'll link to that website from stateofbelief.com.
Great.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate your support. My prayers are with you. Continue to offer the grace of God to everyone, regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity. God bless you.
Later in the show, Bishop Dwayne Royster on the heartless push to sell out Thanksgiving to maximize profits. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. As a pastor of 20 years in Louisiana, I think I'm particularly qualified to be shocked at the audacity of my next guest. At extraordinarily high personal cost, Jerry DeWitt has gone from serving as a fundamentalist faith leader to founder of a chapel serving humanist and atheist persons, all without leaving the intensely conservative and intensely Christian community of Lake Charles, Louisiana. Now, there's no question that the very notion of church for non-believers makes many who claim traditional religions intensely uncomfortable. To that, without any malice, I say, good. Too often, there's a subtle subcontext in American religion that could be described as what's good enough for me should be good enough for thee. More broadly, enforced conformity is not hard to find, especially in the South. So I'm eager to meet a man who is following a vocation with no instruction manual in such an unlikely place. Jerry DeWitt, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I hope I can live up to such a wonderful introduction.
I just want to get clear right here at the very beginning. St. Charles has not become a hotbed of liberalism, has it?
No, it certainly hasn't. And as a matter of fact, I actually live an hour north of Lake Charles, Louisiana, in DeRidder, which is maybe even more conservative, yeah. And of course, much, much smaller.
What led you to such a dramatic transition?
I have lived in and around the DeRidder Lake Charles area all my life. I'm now 44 years of age. And so at age 17, I was saved at Jimmy Swaggart's Church in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I immediately went into the ministry, the denomination of my grandparents, which was Pentecostal. Matter of fact, we prided ourselves on being holier than Pentecostals and referred to ourselves as apostolics. And so for the next 25 years, one degree or the other, I was in the ministry, sometimes evangelizing, sometimes pastoring, and I even added to my public service working at City Hall in DeRidder, Louisiana. I started off as the code enforcement officer and later on ended up being the mayor's chief of staff and the director of community service. I pastored two different churches as the senior pastor. I was the associate pastor for several different churches and spent about 10 years on the highways and byways evangelizing within a very, very strict Pentecostal denomination.
What happened that triggered even the thought of stepping out of that tradition and embracing atheism?
I left Christianity and the ministry in particular kicking and screaming. I did not want to leave. I was not looking to leave. I fought for years intellectually. I fought with my conscience. I fought with the doctrine for years in order to try to stay, in order to maintain a place within my community and within my church world. So the very first catalyst for change was all the way back at the very beginning of my ministry when it became my responsibility to preach the doctrine of eternal punishment and hell. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I took very seriously. And what I like to say is that it's been my love for truth, my love for humanity, and at the time, my love for the God that I was brought up believing in that forced me to consider these issues and over time to change my worldview so substantially that it would have to literally change my world as well.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to convey any implicit sense of superiority about a position, but
sure.
Do you think that being in the fundamentalist tradition caused you to react with a strength that might not have been there had you been in a more progressive position?
Absolutely. I was taught to take things, and this is, now I'm going to sound like I'm being superior or okay. egotistical in some way, but I was taught to take things extremely seriously and to attempt to bring the God of the Bible into my everyday life, right. Not just a Sunday morning experience, not some type of mixture of worldviews or philosophies as we see in a lot of modern forms of Christianity, but to try to relive, to try to enact the very dedication and the lifestyle of the apostles themselves. That's why we called ourselves apostolic. And so, yes, that definitely forced me to live a very particular kind of life.
Jerry, tell me, how far have you changed, or how much have you changed?
This is the way that I like to describe it. I developed a little creed as soon as I began to tour within the secular movement. I quickly learned that different groups call themselves by different names, and I've always sought unity anywhere that I could find it. So what I say is, I say that skepticism is my nature. That makes me a skeptic, obviously. That free thought is my methodology. That agnosticism is my conclusion. And the way that I like to phrase that is that after 25 years of being in the ministry, I have more questions than answers. So agnosticism is my conclusion. Then atheism is my opinion. It's simply an opinion that I hold at this time. But lastly, and most importantly, humanism is my motivation. And what I realized was I had actually been a humanist all along.
Yeah.
So I don't feel any different than I felt when I was in the ministry. Obviously, I do not believe in theistic belief systems anymore, but I still consider myself to be the same loving person that I always was.
Now, how have the people who've known you all of these other years treated you since you have announced where you are now?
You know, it's ranged from being completely disowned by family and friends. I've even had threats, different types of physical threats at different times, usually by strangers, not by, you know, the polite people of the South, all the way to sympathy. You know, people don't realize that sometimes it actually sounds insulting when they find out about your change of beliefs and they say, well, I love you anyway, as if you've been convicted of a crime and they're going to love you anyhow. So the reaction has varied. But in the South, I really feel as if there's a silent yet polite hostility. It seems as if the way that most people are handling it is by attempting to ignore it. You know, every time that I get a little bump in the media, or Community Mission Chapel gets a bump in the media, then social media will have its day for a little while, and then it all quietens back down into, as I call it, a polite hostility.
But they do love you.
But they do love me anyway. Yeah, as if I'm a convicted child molester or something.
That's,
you know,
right.
Which speaks towards one of the reasons that I refused to move, because I felt as if I was being treated as if I had done something wrong. I was 17 years old whenever I started in the ministry. If I didn't make changes by the time that I was 42, something would have been wrong. And so I felt like to move was almost like a plea bargain, you know, almost like pleading guilty so that you can have probation instead of going to court.
Yeah.
And I felt like that wasn't the appropriate thing to do.
You know, Jerry, of all of what you've said, the thing that I found most difficult to understand was why you didn't move, because I know it has to be uncomfortable.
It is, and it is uncomfortable. It's limiting. It's a strange experience. I embedded myself in the community. I love my little town. Like I said earlier, I've even worked at City Hall, and so it's awkward. There's no doubt. It's awkward being a stranger in your own community, but every day it gets a little better. Every day more doors open up. Every day someone meets me who hasn't seen me since all of this has happened, and they're surprised to see that I'm the same person I've always been. Every day I'm recapturing this sense of community and love that I had for 25 years with my town.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Tell us about the chapel. Where did the idea come from for Community Mission Chapel, and what's it been like?
Community Mission Chapel is wonderful. We're still just really getting it going. We haven't yet met nearly any of the goals that we're looking forward to. But basically what happened, December the 1st, 2011, I was fired from a job that I had taken in order to remove myself from the ministry, trying to commit what I call identity starvation. But unfortunately, I was outed, everything got in a turmoil, it all made the papers and such, and I had to commit identity suicide. But as I began to tour in the secular movement, what I quickly realized was just my mannerisms alone seemed to people as if I was preaching. And there was a few people that were bothered by it. They'd been traumatized in some type of fundamentalist church. But by and large, people who had come up in the same background that I had been raised in, they felt a sense of closure by hearing someone speak, not just in a Southern way, but in more of a preaching style. And so I paid attention to that over the course of the last 2 years as I've traveled, and I realized that there is a nostalgic need within many of the lives of secular people, particularly those who are in the South. They're looking for that same sense of community. They're looking for those same cultural elements that they were raised to appreciate, but they're looking for them without the mythology and without the institutionalism of religion. And so I was actually asked by people who were part of a free thought group in Lake Charles, Louisiana, if I would be interested in starting a secular congregation.
Hmm. My goodness. How has the community reacted, just letting you be in the chapel, or have they been pretty negative to you?
Actually, initially, they were very negative. Every time that we make the news again, there'll be just a bombardment of negativity, mm-hmm. generally through social media. They've even went as far as warning other churches that we're out to steal their children somehow, some way. I don't know what we'd do with all of them if we were to steal them, but we're supposed to be stealing them.
Yeah.
And so, but we're going out of our way in order to show that this is actually an act of love,
yeah.
that we're trying to love ourselves, love people who are like us, love people who've experienced the same outcasting that we've experienced, and at the same time, love our community by presenting this option.
Why do you think people have such a hard time understanding atheism and the fact that values, purpose, and a hunger for community can all exist outside of religious faith?
Well, I think first off, we're trained through our experience, our life experience, and our predominant culture within the United States to mix these values together. The value of family, the value of tradition, all mixes with the value of church or religion or synagogue. And so it's not often in our particular culture at this time in American history that we divide those out. And so when we do begin to divide those out and say, well, you can keep your religious traditions, but we're also going to have family values, then that runs contrary to the idea that you are not able to get family values without first getting them from a creator, getting them from some type of, you know, religious sacred document,
mm-hmm.
that you're not able to generate those values within yourself. Where will you get them if you don't get them from the sacred text?
Yeah.
And that's the confusion that has been created within our culture. So obviously there are ways of getting them, and we have them instinctively, internally, mm-hmm. naturally. We have the same love for family that anyone who takes their family to church every Sunday has.
I've got two questions I need you to answer very succinctly, if you will. What's the status of the documentary film about your work, The Outcast of Beauregard Parish?
We're still filming. As a matter of fact, a couple of the producers are in town this week. They hope to interview a few other folks. We're still filming, and hopefully the movie will be released next year.
And I know your book now is out, Hope After Faith, An Ex-Pastor's Journey from Faith to Atheism. What could a reader look for in that?
What they're going to do is they're going to live our lives. The way that we wrote the memoir, the narrative that we've created, takes you step by step, almost day for day, through the life and the experience of a Pentecostal evangelist and a Pentecostal pastor, the ups, the downs, the trials, the sacrifices that are made when a person is trying to live for God with literally everything that they have.
Is there such a thing as a Pentecostal atheist?
As a Pentecostal atheist? You know, there probably will be before it's over. I'm excited about seeing all the changes and the openness that people have. There's Metacostals now,
yep.
So if there can be Metacostals, maybe there can be Pentecostal atheists.
Well, Jerry, what have you learned through this whole process?
I have learned, first and foremost, the necessity of loving yourself. That if you don't love yourself the way that you really should love yourself, then it's going to be impossible for you to love your neighbor appropriately.
Jerry DeWitt's story is one of courage and conviction, and most importantly, of liberation. He's the founder of the Secular Community Mission Chapel in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and he is the author of Hope After Faith, An Ex-Pastor's Journey from Faith to Atheism.
I recommend it, and I equally recommend the audiobook because I read it. And so what more could you ask for?
Good.
My story in my own voice.
Well, Jerry, I admire your courage, and it's been very insightful for me and I think for our listeners to hear you. I thank you so much for being with us here on State of Belief Radio.
The pleasure was all mine.
Work that pays a living wage is a central tenet of justice for workers, and it's a cornerstone of a functioning society. But what about work that keeps workers away from their families during important occasions? Bishop Dwayne Royster is executive director of POWER, which stands for Philadelphians Organizing to Witness, Empower, and Rebuild. As an affiliate of the influential PICO network, Power works to advance social and economic justice in one of the largest cities in this country, and I am really happy to welcome Bishop Royster to State of Belief Radio. Welcome.
Thank you, Doctor. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today.
In recent years, stores have been opening early and earlier to kick off the Christmas shopping season. This time around, some are opening at 8 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day and some at 6 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day. In a tough economy, Bishop, what does that do to workers who can't live without their paycheck but who value their family time?
I believe, Doctor, that it is, in some sense, demoralizing. How these holiday season we're going into, Thanksgiving through the Christmas season, and for other faith traditions, they have holidays going on as well. This is a real emphasis on family. It's emphasis on time spent together. It's emphasis on being present with one another. This is a high travel season, a time spent with folk that we might not see every day, family near and far. And I believe, without a shadow of a doubt, that when we begin to put economics above family, we're really pushing towards the detriment of our community and our economy.
Doesn't this say something pretty negative about our society and the values that we hold?
Absolutely. I think it says a lot about not only the values that we hold, but also that we value the profit over we value our families, our children, our parents, our siblings. And what is exceptionally painful in that is that the folks that are most impacted by this are those that have the least resources to be able to push back and say no.
Yeah. I can't help but think of employers who have been fighting for the right to deny workers' reproductive health care coverage based on religious convictions. Why don't we see more employers protecting their workers' rights based on the same convictions?
Well, I think both of those issues have to do with money and what it will cost them one way or the other with regard to coming out of their profit line, their bottom line, whether it's additional dollars in health care or potential profit loss by not opening on Thanksgiving Day or Thanksgiving evening.
What do you say to your parishioners and the people with whom you associate? What do you say about money? How do we address that? Because no one wants us talking about it. They say, that's my business, not yours. But this becomes the business of the whole society.
When we talk about economics, I think we need to really get to the root of the motivation of economics and the economic engines that exist in our country. Money is a moral neutral, one way or the other. The love of money, as the scripture text says, is the root of all evil. But money itself is a tool, and it's a moral neutral. But it's the motivation behind trying to build up more tools that mm-hmm. becomes part of the problem. And I think we need to be able to articulate that, to be able to have serious discussion about it within our congregations. And I'm, in addition to being executive director of Power, I actually am the pastor of Living Water United Church of Christ and the Oxford Circle section of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And we have conversations about the economics and about how we look at money and really challenging the notion that the economic systems that we have are the best that there is out there. Because as we've seen in most recent years, there's continuing disparity in the creation of a caste system in this country between the haves and the have-nots. As more people in the middle class continue to fall away into the working class or impoverished class in some circumstances, we find that in this country right now, there is this overwhelming sense and need to support those that have more money and making it essentially a sin if you don't have money. Mm-hmm. And we have to begin to change that narrative, go back and think about the resources that we have that are available to us and talk about what is fair and just distribution of wealth in this country. The interesting thing to note for that many of these businesses that are going to open up on Thanksgiving Day, some of them are the largest employers of low-wage workers in the country. Mm-hmm. Walmart, number one, 1.4 million people. Yeah. Kmart and Sears, number five in terms of the low-wage workers in the country, 264,000. Target, number four, 365,000. Macy's, number 12, 171,000. And so when we're talking about low-wage workers, we're talking about people that are making either at minimum wage or just slightly above minimum wage. many of their communities, they can't survive fully on that. So they're desperate to have to be able to be in the workplace on these days when they want to be with their family. And we need to begin to talk about living wage. We need to talk about just wages as a family sustaining option for all in our community.
Bishop, I tell you what, I hear somebody in the background saying, y'all have quit talking about Thanksgiving and you've gone to meddling in our lives.
I want to know how people who are low-wage workers who have to work from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. on Thursday can really have anything to celebrate and give thanks about.
Right, right.
Because if the notions of this country, which, you know, the supposed notion that we're, you know, a Christian nation, the whole nine yards, if that's it, then we're not living into it by making people work on a day when we should be celebrating and giving thanks to family and friends and to God for sustaining us through yet another year. But I think people are going out of a sense of desperation to have to go to work. And although they might be grateful for the job because it provides some level of sustenance, certainly I think they would have better things to do with their time on that day than go to work.
People of faith have always had good relationship, supportive relationship with workers and taking care of them and their families. How can people of faith and others today stand with workers and families on this issue?
I think that there are a variety of ways for us to do that. I think about my work in Power in Philadelphia. We have been working on trying to fight a policy in Philadelphia that is supposed to support low-wage workers with people who are subcontracted with the city of Philadelphia, and the administration of Philadelphia has chosen to ignore that and not apply that law to families. And we've been working diligently along with members of city council to make sure that the administration here in Philadelphia is going to begin to apply that so that folk in who work for subcontractors of government projects here in Philadelphia are going to be able to make 150% of the minimum wage plus benefits. So we stand with them. Power's 43 congregations, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, that are working together to bring our prophetic voice into the town square and to be able to press for policy transformation that will affect low-wage workers, that will affect folks that are struggling the deepest in our communities. We want to help people bring their pain to the town square for their stories to be told and heard, and for them to be able to articulate clearly to political leaders and business leaders what it is they need for ethical government and for ethical business practices. When I think about that work that we've been doing, the work we've been fighting for about low-wage workers at the Philadelphia airport with the expansion that's going to be going on down there, I think that these are the things that we can do to stand and fight together. We ought to be praying for folk. We ought to be doing studies in our congregations about economics and beginning to ask some questions about how economics is applied. Is this really a biblical economics that we're living in today? Or is this really more of capitalist structure that we're using as a framework for our reading of the scripture or text? And then we take out of the text, we proof text, and say, oh, this is capitalism in the text. So what should we really be looking at when we're talking about economics? How do we talk about helping people to be able to glean and to be able to support themselves and sustain themselves instead of having to work a 40-hour work week and still needing medical assistance and still needing food stamps and still needing a variety of other government supports? That doesn't do anything for the dignity of the individual that's working 40-plus hours a week, often in many circumstances, and can't support their family.
Absolutely.
So the faith community has to walk alongside of them to not only be a place to tell them it's okay, but we also have to lift up our prophetic voice and say to business and to political leaders that you're not doing enough, it's not sufficient, we can do better, we must do better.
I think I am correct in saying that the mission of Power extends far beyond worker rights. Isn't that the case?
That is true. We actually have three campaigns that we're working on right now. We are part of the PICO National Network, and so we've been working with them on a campaign for Pathway to Citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country. And in addition to that, Power has actually been working on education organizing, and we are sitting at a table right now with other faith-based organizing movements from across the state of Pennsylvania to, in 2014, invest energy and effort into pressing for full fair, equitable funding formula for all the school districts for the state of Pennsylvania. There are, out of the 500 school districts in the state of Pennsylvania, there are 476 of them that are underfunded. Pennsylvania is only one of three states that does not have a funding formula, and the system that we use right now is anything but equitable. Mm. So we're going to be partnering with congregations, faith leaders from all across the state to press in 2014 for, and in 2015 for a funding formula that will lift up all of our communities, all of the school districts across the state of Pennsylvania, to have sufficient funds to be able to afford for every child in Pennsylvania to have a quality education.
Gosh, that's such great work. Someone sitting listening to this program might say, why are faith leaders all involved in these kinds of political and economic skirmishes? What is the role of faith and faith leaders to help recalibrate the imbalances that have become so obvious in our society? How do you answer that person?
I believe faith leaders and faith in congregations are the moral and ethical conscience of our community and our society. And we ought to be the moral and ethical conscience of our political and business leaders as well. So the work that we do is constantly reminding them of the various faith traditions that we come from that call for caring for the least, the last, and the lost, not always the wealthy, the healthy, and the wise.
Mm.
And so we have an obligation, a responsibility, a call from the text and the narratives that we use as our sacred scripture to speak truth to power and to let them know when we feel that they're moving in a direction that's not healthy for the community as a whole, because oftentimes they're not moving for the health of the community. They're moving for the health of folk that write checks and support them and they think help to get them elected. So part of our journey is to constantly remind them that the real people that they are elected by are the people sitting in pews of congregations of numerous faith traditions, and that they have a responsibility to listen to them and to heed them and to make sure that every decision they make takes their struggles and their pain in consideration.
Bishop Dwayne Royster is Executive Director of Philadelphians Organizing to Witness, Empower, and Rebuild. It is an affiliate of our good friends at the PICO National Network. Bishop Royster, I have an idea that Philadelphia ought to be very grateful that you're there and your people with you there. I admire what you're doing. I appreciate the compassion and integrity with which you speak. And I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. My goodness, I enjoyed doing this show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. Where else can you hear the kind of interviews you've just heard today? We'll use your money wisely to see that State of Belief stays on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, you can watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcast. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. Please tell others about the show so we can have them in this ongoing conversation. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.